I waved back. The woman stooped, picked up a handful of gravel, threw it with force through the gate. The dark boy laughed, shook the rake again. I knew he was one of James's models. This was Danielle.
Jericho was written and read by Dirk Bogard. It was abridged by Neville Teller. The producer was Janet Whittaker. And the story continues tomorrow afternoon at 2:30.
The Digital Station on radio, TV and online. BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Now it's time for part four of The Tent, The Bucket and Me, written and read by Emma Kennedy. And today a major concession is made. Emma's mother agrees that this year's family holiday can be to France, but without the tent. However, the delights of being under a proper roof are soon replaced by a fear of nocturnal noises and strangers in the night.
It was 1977. Star Wars had arrived, and I was obsessed with it. I'd queued up 11 times at my local cinema, collected the bubblegum cards, stared at the plastic dolls in the toy shop, and used up every single penny of my piggy bank money on an amazing lightsaber. I say amazing, but it was just a torch with a length of red tubing that only worked if you stood in the pitch dark. Still, I didn't care. I had a lightsaber. I was a Jedi. The knotty problem of where we were going to go on holiday that year was, as ever, unresolved. 1977 was also Jubilee year, and everyone except my mother was in the grip of a national fervour. Why are we being forced to celebrate someone whose entire life has been paid for by us? We should be like the French, cut all their heads off and boil them down into soap. That's horses, interjected my father, not aristocracy. Anyway, talking of France, she continued, ignoring my father, what about a nice trip into the mountains? We haven't been there. What if we stay in one of those things like the French version of bed and breakfast, except you don't get breakfast and there isn't a landlady? It's more self-catering, but in villages and places like that. What about that? They're called gîtes, mumbled my dad, still not looking up, and I'm not going. We've never stayed in a gîte before, have we, Em? It would be an authentic rustic experience. My mother hadn't been lying when she said we were going to immerse ourselves in remote French culture. As we pulled into the tiny village of Bourg-Aguesse in the Auvergne, I was shocked by just how remote it was. There were no shops, a handful of houses, some of which were already crumbling into ruins, and very few signs of life. Eventually, we found what appeared to be a charming country cottage, painted white and with a large sloping stone tile roof. It was on the verge of looking as if it had been scraped off a chocolate box. Inside, it was rather gloomy. One long trestle table, covered in red plastic gingham, dominated the central space, while to the left was a large fireplace trimmed with matching gingham and decorated with an assortment of inexplicable knick-knacks, a pine cone, a candle holder in the shape of a platform boot, and a small porcelain Minnie Mouse. On the wall, just behind the front door, there was a small television set sitting on a purpose-made ledge, and just below that, in the murk of the corner, there seemed to be a black cupboard-shaped object. But at that moment, I wasn't quite able to make out what it was. "Is it my imagination?" said my mother later, as we sat round the trestle table, having unpacked. "Or is that small cupboard over there moving?" I looked up. The black mass I'd spotted earlier and assumed was a cabinet was indeed appearing to shift its shape. The three of us sat transfixed as the early evening sun brought a small pale spotlight to the darkened corner. The surface was moving. "What the hell?" said my father, moving slowly towards it. "Oh my God," he yelled as he got close enough to see what it was. "It's not a cupboard. It's an ant's nest. What? Screamed my mother, leaping up from the bench. Don't be ridiculous. It's massive. I'm not joking, said my father, examining it further. It's a bloody ant's nest. The whole thing is an ant's nest. Some of them have got wings, Brenda. They're everywhere. Well, pour boiling water on it or something, wailed my mother, who had edged herself to the far wall. Boiling water isn't going to do it, said my father, shaking his head. This needs an exterminator. This is an infestation. Oh, what are we going to do? Do you want to use my lightsaber? I offered, turning it on and holding it out. Not now, Emma, snapped my mother. Can't we just move it outside? I said, giving the whole thing a once over. You know, just pick it up and chuck it out. Yes, Tony, said my mother from the safety of the other side of the room. Why don't you do that? You could use one of those plaster bags in that room upstairs, I said. I was displaying the sort of skills that would make me a Jedi yet. Mum hatched a plan. Dad would wear a long sleeve shirt back to front to protect his arms, oven gloves on his hands, and her own voluminous Brigitte Bardot-style sunglasses to fend off any attacks to the eyes. Suitably armoured, he would, in what we hoped would be one deft movement, slip the plaster bag over the top of the ant's nest, scoop it up, and dump it down the well. At least that was the idea. It all started very well. My mother handed my father the bag exactly as he had wanted. Crouching slightly and with a quick grit of the teeth, Tony positioned the open end of the bag immediately above the ant's nest, stretching it between his oven gloves. Right, Brenda, he said, letting his weight fall forward onto his front foot. Get a hold of the bottom. Ready? She nodded. With one quick dive to his knees, the bag fell to the floor. Grabbing its edges as best he could, he gathered them together and gave the whole thing an upwards yank. But it wouldn't come away. Somewhere, it was attached. Where the bloody hell? Yelled Dad, scrabbling to see what was keeping the nest tethered. Ants were already pouring out of the bag and covering the oven gloves. Oh, no! Shouted Dad. It's attached to this beam! Oh, quick! Get me something I can hit it with! Quick! Sensing that my moment of destiny had come, I turned on my lightsaber, strode forward, plastic tube aloft, and started bashing at the back of the sack with everything I had. What I had failed to realise was that my souped-up torch had no cutting power whatsoever, and unlike a real Jedi, my aim was not what it might be. Instead of cutting the nest free and becoming the hero of the hour, I just managed to hit the sack repeatedly, sending more ants spilling out and up onto my father. No! He shouted in a squeal reserved for disastrous occasions. No, Emma, don't do that! Oh, God, Brenda, get me a knife or something! My mother, now running around the room in frenetic splendour, came back brandishing nothing sharper than a log. Dad, realising that still holding the bag was pointless, let go, took the log and used it to smash at the back of the nest. That didn't work. So instead, he set at it with his foot, stamping away at it and letting out a strange primeval scream as he did. His shoe, which was a soft brown suede, had, I noticed, turned black with ants, which were now running up his trouser leg. Desperate to get this whole sorry incident over with, Dad then just grabbed at the nest with the oven gloves and pulled at it until with one sharp snap, the whole thing came away. Scrambling to get a hold of the bag ends and scooping as many ants into it as he could, Dad then picked up the whole thing and ran, still screaming, into the garden where the whole lot was thrown with some venom down the well. Oh, Tony, said my mother, pouring calamine lotion onto a cloth. You've been bitten everywhere. My father's leg was in a terrible state, a join-the-dots mass of red raised welts that ran from his ankle all the way to his groin. The noise started as soon as we'd gone to bed. Bonk. Bonk. Something was on the roof. My parents, who were in the room on the ground floor, were having an even worse night of it. Not only were they having to put up with the sporadic and mysterious bonk, but they were also battling with a strange fizz emanating from the fridge and a puzzling crackle popping from the turned-off television set. The bonk was relentless. Worse still, there was no discernible pattern to it, which meant I lay awake waiting for it to sound again. "Can you hear that noise?" asked my dad, poking his head round my door. "Can you hear it up here?" "Yes," I said, face glued to my pillow in eternal hope. "What is it?" "I don't know," said Dad. "Can I borrow your lightsaber?" I got out of bed and felt around in the dark. Finding the handle, I pulled it towards me and flicked it on. I gasped a little. In the treacle black of the bedroom, my lightsaber looked magnificent. I had never seen it burn so sharp or so brilliant. Taking the lightsaber from me, my father unlatched the shutters, opened the window, and leaning out as far as he dared, tried to stare up at the roof. "Can't see anything," he said with a grimace. Below him, suddenly, there was a sound of rushed steps on gravel. "What the?" said my dad, turning round sharply, but it was too late. Whoever, or whatever it was, had gone. "Right," he said, shutting the window back up with some force. "That's it. We're all sleeping in the same room from now on." We had not slept well. I'd woken up with my father's elbow in my eye. My mother was complaining that her back might actually be broken, and Dad had lain awake for most of the night with a log in his hand. The next night, our old friend, the bonk, returned. As we lay squashed together in the upstairs bedroom, our imaginations were running riot. "Do you think someone's on the roof?" whispered Brenda, staring up at the ceiling. "No, Brenda," said Tony, trying to keep his sanity. "Unless it's the tiniest man known to living science. It'll be an animal, like a rat. In fact, I'm going to put a stop to this. Pass me a lightsaber, Emma, and turn the lamp off. I'm going to have another look." For the second time, my father approached the shuttered windows. Very gently and quietly, he pulled them open, and with the softest of touches, pushed open the windows. Grabbing hold of the window frame, he turned so that he could sit on the window ledge, legs facing into the room, and lean back so as to get a good look at the roof. My mother, concerned that he was going to hurt himself, held onto his legs and said, "Don't fall out, Tony. If you do, I'll kill you." I remained in the centre of the bed, clutching onto the blankets. My lightsaber fizzed into action. "Still can't see anything," whispered Dad, his face drifting in and out of the red light. "Wait a minute. Something's moving. What the... Jesus!" Something darted across the beam of light. Whatever it was now in the room and moving fast. My mother, feeling something spit past her, decided that now was as good a time as any to start screaming. Dad had jumped back off the window ledge into the room and was desperately swinging the lightsaber around in order to catch a glimpse of whatever it was. "Turn the light on!" he yelled in my direction. "Put the light on!" Terrified, I reached over to the lamp and found its switch. I was now also screaming, and as the light snapped on and my father shouted, "It's a bat! It's a bloody bat!" my mother and I screamed again and continued to scream as my father, using the lightsaber, tried to chase it out the window. Mum was now running round the room in a bent-over hunch with both her arms over her head. My father, both hands on the lightsaber, was swiping at the air, ducking and spinning in turns, desperate to get the bat out of the room. I stared at him, glued into this unfolding horror, and realised what my father had to do. "Use the Force, Dad!" I yelled. "Use the Force!" The bat, flapping its blackened wings, dived, just skimming the surface of the bed, rose, circled the top of the room, and then, as my father made one enormous sweep into the air, shot like a bullet from a gun out the open window. It was over. My father ran to the shutters and slammed them shut. My mother was on her knees and panting. I was peering over the top of the blankets. "Do you know what, Dad?" I said, as my parents both got back into bed. "You are the master." "Thanks," said my dad, hitting his pillow with his hand. "Now let's just try and get some sleep."
The Tent, The Bucket and Me was written and read by Emma Kennedy, and it was abridged and produced by Jill Waters. It's a Waters Partnership production for the BBC, and the story concludes tomorrow afternoon at 3:15.
He's always worrying about that damn contract. Is it worth anything? Is it not worth anything? Who's the latest person to check it over? Doesn't stop.
Leonid has been a good friend to you. Helped you when you were down. You repay his kindness with such rudeness.
Be quiet, can't you?
If life seems better outside the village...
That's why you wanted to be with me right from the start. Just to win Matt's confidence.
It probably isn't.
We can't trust any of them, for God's sake, Lillian!
Ambridge Extra, the series finale. Next Tuesday and Thursday afternoon at 2:15 on BBC Radio 4 Extra.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
It's 3 o'clock and welcome. It's Alan Smith with you here on 4 Extra, and we're about to indulge ourselves in an hour of top-class drama. That's next. And later, with the comedy starring Martin Clunes as Roy, who's lost his job and blown his chance of romance, but finds help from an unexpected quarter. Find out what it is in The Older Woman at 5:30. Time for drama now on 4 Extra, and first published in 1919, Mr. Standfast is the third of 5 Richard Hannay novels by John Buchan. The title refers to a character in John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress, which is referred to frequently in this adventure, as Hannay uses a copy of the book to decipher coded messages from his contacts and letters from his imprisoned friend.
Er lebt noch.
Scheibe.
Engländer, komm raus und halte die Hände hoch.
Mein Name ist Peter Pinner. Marenke's Lieutenant, Royal Flying Corps, Squadron 19. And don't you bloody call me an Englishman.
Mr. Standfast by John Buchan. Dramatised in 2 parts by Bert Cools. Episode 1.
I'd started out in khaki in 1914 with nothing more than a great wish to see the whole business finished. But after 3 years, I'd acquired a professional interest in the thing. I had a nailing good brigade and a chest so full of gongs it looked like the high priest's breastplate. So you can imagine the infamous temper I was in at being recalled to England.
So, how was the Somme? You came out of it with a DSO.
And a promotion.
Brigadier General Richard Hannay.
Mm. Walter, is there a point to this? Frankly, I don't take kindly to being called away from my men when we're on the brink of a big push.
Of course there's a point, and you know it. We want you back in with us. Huh? The old game.
No, I've told you, I'm not cut out for the Secret Service. There must be someone better suited.
Not for this mission. Now, stop wasting time. Duty's duty, and we both know perfectly well that you're going to say yes.
Hell and damnation!
What Sir Walter Bullivant wanted me to do would have been bad enough for anyone. But for me, strong as a bull, sunburnt as a gypsy, and not looking my 40 years, It was a black disgrace. My stomach rose at the thought of it.
Fighting the Germans is pointless. I simply don't understand why we're doing it.
It's so good to meet another kindred spirit.
Our own tiny pacifist community, all in revolt against this ludicrous war.
What is your particular stance, Mr. Brand?
I believe that a little common sense and civilised discussion would settle it right away.
With a little common sense and civilised discussion, it would never have started in the first place.
Ah, Lancelot. Just in time for dinner, clever boy. Our cousin, Mr. Brand.
Lancelot Wake. Mr. Cornelius Brand.
Wake?
Brand.
Good evening.
I'm sure you two men will have so much in common.
Lancelot's a CEO.
A conscientious objector. Well, that explained the sallow skin, the fanatical eyes, and the fact that he'd rather more hair on his head than most of us.
Do you know, Mr. Brand, no one's done better work for the cause than Lancelot.
Question.